Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School at the ANU, and I also head the Poverty and Inequality Research Centre and the Children's Policy Centre. And I'm here today with Anna-Greta Hunter. Hi, Anna-Greta.
Hi, Sharon. It's great to be with you again.
We're back.
We are. And I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician. I'm part of the ANU Medical School, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow at ANU this year.
Policy Forum Pod is produced by Policy Forum Net here at the Crawford School. The Crawford School is the Asia Pacific's leading graduate public policy school. We have an amazing array of degree programs and short courses. And starting from next year, we have an exciting model of both online and face-to-face teaching. So do check out what we have on offer at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. We would love to see you here and be able to continue some of these incredible conversations that we're having around a wellbeing economy and reimagining the future with you. Anna-Greta, what have we got in store today?
Well, we're going to continue on our exploration and our not-so-hostile takeover of the Policy Forum Pod. This mini-series has been focusing on the wellbeing economy that we dreamt up as a result of discussions after the federal budget this year, and particularly in light of what we saw as a real missed opportunity for economic change to combat the sorts of serious challenges that are around us. We were particularly struck, I think, by how we value or probably fail to value the role of caring within our community, caring for the elderly, caring for children and friends and family. So over the past four episodes, we've had a fantastic journey. We've started by speaking to John Quiggin about economics, about how it works and how it might change. We solved climate change, or at least we had a fantastic conversation along those lines with Tim Hollow and Mark Howden. We spoke to Guy Standing about the universal basic income and how that change in public policy would help to slay what he sees are the eight giants that are confronting humanity. And of course, we spoke to David Hume about poverty and how economic change would address what remains to be a significant human and environmental challenge around the world. So today's episode, we'd like to talk about health, wellbeing, and economics and how those things might be related. I thought I might start with a little bit of framing for today's discussion. A study from the medical journal The Lancet that was published a few years ago estimated the carbon footprint from the Australian healthcare industry at around 7% of the total Australian carbon footprint. This is a number that's roughly equivalent with international comparisons in other countries. More than 10% of working Australians are employed in the healthcare or caring work. However, most of the carbon cost from healthcare actually comes from the use of pharmaceuticals and from hospitalisation, rather than from the caring work that goes with the health industry as an employment model. There are some great projects that are underway, particularly through the Global Green and Healthy Hospitals Network, which are aiming to decrease the carbon footprint associated with the healthcare industry, particularly by encouraging the transition to renewable energy and looking at issues around waste. However, this energy transition and waste reduction is only one part of this puzzle. In the practice of medicine, we know that there are some low-value healthcare in practice. There are things that happen in hospitals and in healthcare that don't make a big difference to either quality or quantity of life. And more importantly, we know that many of the diseases and conditions that we treat with pharmaceuticals and hospital admissions and procedures are preventable if we can better address the social determinants of health. Improving education, relationships, providing adequate economic and social support can make a profound impact on health and well-being. Add to this improved nutrition and physical activity, and we probably have a much healthier society. But the impacts of this maybe utopian type transition on the industry of healthcare, on the economics of the healthcare system, would be quite profound. Our healthcare business runs on activity, and often on the more carbon intensive aspects of medical practice, these are the most financially rewarding. So if our population becomes healthier, the business of medicine, the money side, might need to change. It's an interesting tension for the health industry to address, and I hope that it frames our conversation today in a way, as I suspect we'll touch on a number of those issues through our discussion. So today's main questions are, how does economics affect our health? How does changing economic models improve health and well-being?
So, Anna-Greta, I'm really looking forward to this conversation, and I'm delighted to say that, as we discussed on last week's episode, we wanted to invite the amazing Sharon Friel to join us for this conversation, and we have enticed her to be here with us. So we are delighted to have Sharon with us. And Anna-Greta, you also have some level of expertise in issues around the social determinants of health. So I'm really excited about hearing both of your views on this. As many of our listeners will know, Sharon Friel is Professor of Health Equity at the ANU School of Regulation and Global Governance. Sharon is also Director of the Menzies Centre for Health Governance, and she's an extraordinary thinker who over the past several years has changed how many of us here think about health, economics and climate change in particular. Sharon is a global leader in health equity, having led the WHO Commission on the Social Determinants of Health between 2005 and 2008. She is a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences Australia and co-director of the NHMRC Centre for Research Excellence in Social Determinants of Health Equity. In 2014, her peers internationally voted her as one of the world's most influential female leaders in global health. That is quite a CV to bring to the discussion. Sharon, it's great to have you here. Hello.
Hello. Delighted to be with you both.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
So we are going to talk about the social determinants of health and really focus on some of these issues about how we can improve health and well-being. But before we go to that conversation, I really want to just note, Sharon, that you are also host of Dinner Ladies Save the World, a podcast series produced here at the ANU. And I believe you're going to be hosting a special Christmas episode this year. Can you tell us a bit more about what you have in store for us through that podcast?
Well, I can't do the full reveal because, of course, you have to listen in. But actually, the title of the podcast of the Christmas special is Utopia. So really, it's very much to what you're speaking about over this mini-series. And really, you know, the Dinner Ladies Save the World podcast came about, you know, a number of female academics from across the ANU getting together over dinner, rueing the state of the world, the state of the university in particular, and really just trying to say, how can we support each other in that? And of course, for us right now in this state of the world and the reimagining that you've been doing through this mini-series, really getting together to say, okay, what can the future look like and how do we get there?
I think 2020 has been something of a dystopian nightmare for so many people. And at this moment in time, thinking about what utopia might look like and how we can create it, I think is actually fundamentally important for all of us. So Looking forward to their podcast and to this discussion today.
Absolutely. No, utopia, economics, these are part of the themes of 2020, along with how we can undertake radical transformation. So economics, healthcare, and how to solve difficult problems. Sharon, perhaps a first question is a more straightforward one. How do economics influence our health and well-being?
Well, I mean, if you think of the dominance of economics and how economics shapes the paradigm of the decisions that happen in every sector within society, and if we appreciate that every sector within society has some sort of implication for our health, then the very fact that economics is shaping every sector within society. And I mean, I think we have to ask the question of economics as, you know, what is the purpose? And I would argue that it's a means to an end, it's not the end. And I think what we've seen within societies writ large is the strive to think about the economy, economics and the economy, as if that's the goal that we're seeking. But the fact that the economy, economics, income, inequality matters for people's everyday material resource. It shapes the ability for us to afford houses. It shapes the cost of houses. It shapes the way in which we design our cities. It shapes the rural opportunities. It shapes the differential access to education. And all of these things fundamentally affect our physical and mental well-being. Then we cannot separate the economy from human health. And again, I would ask, if we ask the question of economics and the economy of for what purpose, it has to be as a means to an end. And so I think what we're talking about today is, what is that end that we're trying to reach or strive towards? And I would say that would have to be a much better distribution of health, much better health, much better distribution of health, and much better social and environmental outcomes. That's what the economy should be working towards.
So what do you think the economy is doing at the moment? If we've got a model of alternative, what sort of drivers do you think? Is it all about power?
Well, I think underpinning the economy is all about power. So if we think of the unfettered market, which is all about striving towards profit at any cost. And so the dominant economic paradigm is what underpins that market approach towards the unfettered market towards profits. I have no issue with profit. I have an issue as to how we get to those profits. And because the negative externalities that are arising from that economic model, we see, and so this might lead into our consumptogenic systems. So if we agree that a consumptogenic system or the global consumptogenic system is absolutely based upon and driven by an unfettered market, which is all about increasing profits, and that is absolutely dependent on fossil fuels to drive that, you know, it's about production and consumption if we want to get all Marxian. But really what that system is, it's public policies, it's business practices, it's social norms, it's institutional norms, it's ways of governing that think that that economic model is what we should have and what we should strive towards. And the negative externalities from that is much poorer health outcomes, because we drive excess consumption, we drive societies to think we need and want and we want more and we're not as good as our neighbours because we haven't got all of that, and that's not good for our mental health either. But it also drives inequality, going back to the income inequality, which loops around to affect our health as well. And of course, it absolutely drives environmental degradation and climate change. So what's our economy for? Surely it can't be for that.
Absolutely. You did publish a book 2 years ago, Climate Change and the
The People's Health.
A book that I've recommended to many people, and in fact I've given away quite a few copies to various people so that they can take on board the message. Could you explain to us what the consumptogenic system model is and how it might frame my understanding of health and wellbeing more completely?
Yeah, so that consumptogenic system, if you think of our everyday, we're sitting in this room, in this boiling hot room, which is sort of driven by fossil fuels, you know, to keep us in this room. We've all got our paraphernalia in front of us that's all been produced, manufactured based on a fossil fuel model, which has been facilitated through trade and investment policy that moves these things around the world and encourages more and more production and consumption of these sorts of things. I'm looking around Martin's office and I don't see junk food. I was expecting a little plate of cookies, but I don't see any junk food. Junk food, for example, would be one of those products that comes out of a system that, you know, greater production of high value products that make a lot of money and are traded and invested around the world, which are just so bad for us from a health perspective, you know, excess consumption of that. But of course, the marketing and the price signals drive us to want to consume all of that. So a consumptogenic system, it's not just about food, but it's about all facets of policy that encourages more production and consumption of products and services that have these health risks. Of course, there's great things in there, but there's excess health risks. You know, that's why we see the levels of poor health that we see around the world, that are sort of valued unequally around the world, and so leads to this inequality. And, you know, as I was saying before about the absolute dominance of reliance on fossil fuel. And so there's a great opportunity to recalibrate that consumptogenic system. If we think about the governance, if we think about the public policies and the regulatory frameworks, if we think about industry practices and the incentives for industry, and if we think about societal norms, it's the recalibration of all of those things that would help us get towards a valuing of products and services and ways of being that is better for health, better from a social equity perspective, and better from an environmental perspective. Sorry, that was a bit of a long ramble about the consumptogenic system. But
no, I mean, it reminds me of the beginning that we had of our conversation around climate change, where we talked about turning the tap off and thinking about the implications if we stopped burning fossil fuel, all of it, today. And in my mind, one of the things that pops up quite quickly is trade and global trade and the way in which we move stuff around and the way that then follows on to impact on us.
Yeah.
If we thought, I guess, about the stuff that we buy and the stuff that we trade and the stuff that we need through the health prism, it might be I think that's really part of what your thesis gives us, is both the environmental footprint as well as the health footprint of the sort of economic activity that drives much of human activity in the world.
Sharon, I'm interested in starting to think about where we begin to address some of the problems that underpin that consumptogenic model. And I guess the first thing I'm really interested in hearing your views on how we think about this in terms of global inequality and what is sometimes called development, not necessarily positive development, but in a society like Australia, there is clearly an enormous amount of consumption and a lot of stuff that's consumed that is not in people's own interests and not necessarily leading to better health or wellbeing outcomes. In many countries of the global south, you know, the model of development has been around trying to pursue that same model. And one of the challenges that's often raised is how do those countries that have reached this level of consumption now turn around and say, we need to put a halt to this, when many people in the global south feel as though they're just on the brink of that kind of acquisition, if you like, of consumer goods. And so there's often, you know, this concern or this issue raised about the issues of global inequality and where we need to start in terms of pulling back from this consumptogenic model. What's your thinking around how we think about these issues in the global context? Is it wealthy countries that need to take a lead here and where regulation needs to start, or do we need to think about this globally, including in emerging middle-income countries and low-income countries that are perhaps striving for models of higher consumption?
Yeah, so I don't think it's an either or. I mean, the level of injustice in this is phenomenal, of course, because it's been a tiny fraction of countries, institutions and populations that have contributed to certainly to the emissions, but are being key players. Anna Greta asked about, is this about power? Well, if you think about the inequities in global power, then absolutely. So it's not an either or. So if we think about those at that global level, I mean, the way we might think about it is a contraction and a convergence. And so a major contraction among those high income countries, those high polluting countries, those countries that the market, the price, all of the signals that encourage consumption needs to stop, or it certainly needs to contract. Which allows a level of increase among those countries that you're speaking about, Sharon. But at the same time, within those countries, not to follow the same trajectory of the high-income countries, but to really, I mean, if development and development aid really wanted to do this well, you're actually supporting countries. I mean, just think about all of the industries, the different products and services that are produced in those low middle income countries as forms of development. They can be green. I'm doing that with an inverted commas. It doesn't have to be based on fossil fuels, and it doesn't have to be based on corrupt working conditions, and it doesn't have to be based on everything that leads to all of the poor health outcomes. It can be done in a way that, so it can be development that's based on principles of environmental sustainability and social equity and health. So that can be happening at the same time, which allows the emergence of sort of consumerism, but sustainable consumerism within low and middle income countries, but high income countries and institutions absolutely have to contract. There's just, otherwise we are stuffed.
So I'm thinking, as you're talking about the Pacific Island states in particular and the devastating impacts of climate change there, and the fact that there are nation states, societies and cultures in the Pacific that are under threat of no longer being because of rising sea levels and all of the loss that comes with that. And the kind of discourse that leaders of some of those countries have tried to kind of bring to the global agenda in terms of reshaping our thinking so that we are thinking not just about consumption, but about the maintenance of, those vulnerable, fragile states that are under such threat in the Pacific, but also thinking much differently and starting to think about maintaining societies and about well-being. Where do you think leadership is likely to come from globally to sort of shift the global discourse? Because what strikes me is when we hear leaders from the Pacific, and not necessarily only the political leaders from the Pacific, but, Pacifica peoples talking about the need to shift the paradigm in order for their societies and their cultures and their way of life to be preserved, it is incredibly powerful and it is incredibly moving. And I'm convinced, and I think many people who hear that are convinced, and yet the global discourse is so difficult to shift. So where do you see leadership coming from in terms of shifting some of those global paradigms?
Yeah, well, so I suppose, so we have a moment, I think you were reflecting on this earlier, we have a moment because of COVID-19 where health is up there with the economy. Never before has health been in the same conversation as the economy. And health in a now, you know, being spoken about in much more of a well-being sense. So it's right up there. So where's the leadership? So I think there's a diversity of leadership that is needed. I certainly don't think there's any one place. I do think we're seeing much greater voice of social movements. So Black Lives Matter, I think we're going to see much more of Extinction Rebellion to do with climate change. We've got the youth climate movement. In the US, certainly, there's a whole poverty campaign that's really taking off across the country, and that we'll have social contagion from that as Europe slides into recession. So I think those social movements will start to coalesce. So you have a push up from the social movement. So not only in terms of providing support among societies and peoples, but you have a push up from those social movements. And of course, historically, we've seen that it's been the social movements and the political struggles that are pushed through the social movements that has created political commitment. And I just think, you know, I am an eternal optimist. I just can't imagine how not to be at this point, because otherwise it's just pure despair. But if we've got health and the economy up there sitting together, here in Australia, we're about to go through another summer from hell. So climate change, and of course the Australian government is being shamed by other states around the world in terms of climate change and mitigation policy. So there'll be momentum happens there, and so we'll start to see more states coalesce around action on climate change, pushing up from the youth movement. We had a little bit of mention of trade and investment. So the whole trade and investment regime is undergoing a reform and thinking about trade and investment through the Sustainable Development Goals framework, which is incredible. Now, of course, there'll be all sorts of pushback from that. But in the trading system, every country has a voice. And so actually many of the Pacific Island countries have been quite vocal in the trade system because they've got a voice, you know, in equal to others. So I think we're going to see leadership play out in lots of different rooms, I think, at different levels. And I think that's marvellous. I don't think we should be looking just one place. People are super excited that the World Economic Forum is talking about the Great Reset. Oh, good grief, how fantastic. But of course, they won't do anything because they're all the political elites, and that's fine to say that and keep themselves as they fly off to Mars. But still, that's an important performance and signal. And, you know, so lots of different places will demonstrate fabulous leadership. And if we look nowhere else, we look to New Zealand and we see compassionate leadership in spades. So just having the dignity and the human decency to understand that as a political leader, you're there to look after the people who have voted you in. So I think we'll start to see more of that globally. Mm.
That was the optimistic moment of for 2020, when we saw the New Zealand election and we saw the ACT election and we saw movements to perhaps in communities where there's less fear of change. There's an enthusiasm for things to be different and for the future to be better than the past. There's been a bit of stuff written that the sorts of radical transformations that might be required, the rejigging of our economic priorities towards well-being or towards health and environment, this sort of radical transformation may often involve conflict. Are you optimistic that this can be achieved without conflict?
Gosh.
It tests my optimism.
You know, look, I think we're going to see more unruliness on the streets. I think we'll see more and more of those large grouping demands. I think, again, the lessons from the past, where there have been incredible success yeah, incredible success stories, you know, nuclear disarmament, the women's movement. There were just all sorts of forms of resistance mm. that took place. Some of that, of course, was incredibly peaceful, and sometimes there was unrest. I don't know how this all plays out, but as I say, I just think it needs to be the coalitions of unusual bedfellows that, if we're concerned about well-being, health, equity, and the environment, then we coalesce together to demand change.
I think on that note of what could be achieved and the way in which coalitions can come together to achieve it is a good point on which to take a short break, let people reflect for just a moment, and we will return in just a minute to continue this conversation.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're continuing the conversation with Professor Sharon Friel. And Sharon, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with Guy Standing from University College London. And one of the things that I asked him about, because I am very exercised by this at the moment, is the very punitive policies that we see in many countries, particularly the UK through universal credit and in Australia through robo-debt, towards people in need of welfare benefits. And over recent weeks, we've seen the robo-debt fiasco in Australia being deemed as inappropriate. We saw an out-of-court settlement, and we've heard over and over again about the devastating impacts on people of the robo-debt situation. And we know that that had such a terrible impact on people's lives and well-being. There are very credible reports of suicides that were genuinely deaths of despair coming out of that, what I think we can only call a fiasco. But we haven't seen any minister being held to account as yet. We haven't seen anyone taking responsibility. And so I guess the question that I have for you is, how do we come out of something like that experience and use it as a moment in time when we can start to think differently about people's welfare and well-being and how the state, but also as a society, we respond to people who need support? And as a second part of that big question, how do we think about leadership and responsibility for policies that have such a devastating impact on people's health and well-being?
I think the whole robo-debt fiasco has really illustrated the lack of social contract that we have within Australian society. I always marvel when we talk about, you know, the country, you know, it's the fair go, and we don't have a class structure here, and of course we absolutely do. And I think fundamentally what is underpinning all of that is the way that we're seeing currently with our political leaders is not actually considering people as people, but rather being very much within that paradigm of people as makers of the economy. And so it's, again, the value set of our political leaders that just completely obscures the fact that we're talking about humans and humans' lives. So I would love to see an introduction of a social contract within Australia, and that relates to some of the things that we were just speaking about previously of, you know, the coalitions, the social connections between communities, within communities, and being part of a democratic system of discussion, reimagining of our society together. And also, I mean, RoboDebt, I mean, it just makes you sick to your stomach, really, when you think what that has done to people. But of course, it also reminds us that we have to think about artificial intelligence and these forms of technology and ask for what purpose and based on what sort of regulatory framework and what principles are built into these forms of, or these, I don't even know the right word, but into artificial intelligence. It also reminds me of, you know, there was such great promise of the intervention by the Australian government, the federal government, around job seeker, you know, and income support. And there we saw, because of COVID, we saw an additional $550 every fortnight. That's been pulled back to $250, and come January that'll be $150. And there's been some lovely analysis by colleagues here at the ANU who've estimated that that's actually going to send 330,000 people into poverty. Good God. So we've got to ask the question, but of course the intervention, that promising intervention around, you know, the $550, that wasn't, I don't think, based on a care for those people. That was, how do we get people to spend money? You know, talking about consumption. So we're going to try and come out of COVID through a consumption-led recovery, which is just incredibly problematic. And still no reflection, political reflection, on what is the purpose of these policies. And I would love our Prime Minister to just stop and ask, does he think it's okay to send people back into the financial situation that we will see people die? Is that okay? Because that's what we'll see when people shift back into those levels of poverty and all of the multidimensional aspects of poverty of the work that you do, Sharon. Do we think that that is okay, Prime Minister? And surely a reflection in the mirror has to say, no, that's not okay.
Absolutely. And, this is the reason we're talking about economics. And I'm just reflecting back over some of the conversations we've had so far. John Quiggin at the beginning of this series set up our ideas around economic activity, that we historically in the 20th century were making stuff, physical things, and that there's been this transition towards an information or service-led economy. And then the way that Tim Hollow framed this really still resonates with me quite deeply, that it's about extraction. And we've either been extracting stuff from the world around us and trying to really monetize the physical environment that we're in, or we've really commoditized the human existence. And that's part of what we're reflecting here, that the value of the human life in the society that we face. And so this is why economics is such an interesting set of discussions about how we can improve health and well-being. Because when we do give people an extra $500 a fortnight, I see in the work that I do as a medical practitioner, that has real and material impacts on their health and well-being in a positive light. And so if that's what drives us as a community, how can we reset that policy agenda?
Well, and again, it comes back to, you know, what we were speaking about before in terms of those coalitions and the coalition of unusual bedfellows. And implicit in all of that is diversity. And, you know, I think it's incredibly disappointing that the governance, the national cabinet, the national committees that we've seen in COVID is just so lacking in diversity. There's been a little bit of attention paid to it, but it's just so lacking. So we've got the usual old white men still at the table making the decisions, and what we know from history and what we know from elsewhere is when there are diverse voices around the table, then you get much greater reflection and different viewpoints. But that means you have to be kind of courageous and, you know, let go of your power and be happy with that diversity of perspectives. And wouldn't that be a lovely political leadership to demonstrate? I think you mentioned Tim's work, Tim Hollow and colleagues who have sort of written about the extraction and extractive capitalism, and of course the sort of the counter to that, and which I think what we're speaking about is regeneration or regenerative capitalism. I don't think capitalism's ever going to be going away, certainly not in my lifetime. But wouldn't it be nice to recalibrate that to be regenerative? And so, yes, you can still have economic prosperity, but you can also have it in ways that's good for health, good for society, and good for the environment. And I do just think it's the political struggle, it's the social resistance, it's the using of the inside and the outside game. I mean, I think of colleagues within the government, within the bureaucracy, and there are fantastic colleagues at the federal, state, local levels who care about exactly these sorts of things. And they have power, you know, not all of the time, and sometimes it's not explicit, but they do have power, and the building of the relations that they are so able to do just so exquisitely, that seeing a little window open, you know, we will see a little window open when it comes to climate change policy, I think, as this government is shamed by others around the world. So there will be a little window that opens and voices will be able to come in through that window. And at the same time, we have others who are pushing to open the windows. And I think what's so important is then being able to articulate very clearly what the pathways forward are. Yeah, you know, it's all very well. It's so easy to sit and criticise, you know, as a researcher, that's, you know, probably about 70% of my job is to be critiquing policy. But it's so, you know, and then colleagues say, well, OK, well, what do you want it to look like? And so collectively having some suggestions as to those pathways forward towards that utopia that we started speaking about.
Is it time
about?
To be imagining a utopia? I mean, I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah. You know, like there's going to be, you know, people will roll their eyes as they're listening to this podcast and think, oh, for God's sake, you know, that's just all motherhood and apple pie. And that's absolutely true, it is. But unless we have some sort of vision of an alternative, then we will simply return to business as usual. I think there will probably be a pragmatic approach towards that utopia. And maybe that's okay.
Sharon, I think before we end this conversation, we will come back to what utopia might look like and maybe how we get there. But I wanted to pick up on the comment that you made about the importance of diversity. And clearly that's important in terms of decision making. And, you know, as you pointed out, we haven't necessarily seen that diversity in decision making in Australia. The other place I think where diversity really matters is in terms of the public discourse and the public debates. And it always seems to me that, you know, one of the real problems, and I think this isn't only apparent to me, but the rest of the world, that one of the real problems with social media is that people do end up in genuine echo chambers where you're reinforcing your own ideas and you're shutting out any other idea that you don't like. I know I do this myself. I'm always find that everyone's in agreement on Twitter until I kind of step out of my chamber, and I'm quite shocked to hear how differently many people think. And so I think that's a problem in terms of us having conversations with one another rather than in parallel. But of course, the other problem, and the equally big problem, is the nature of the what we might call the traditional or the mainstream media, and the dominance of a small elite, of most of that media, and the fact that is a profit-driven industry, that it sits very much often within a kind of a neoliberal paradigm. And so we have these dual problems of the mainstream media not taking up the challenge for the most part about how we have a diversity of views and discussions in a respectful way that broadens out the conversation. And we have the problems of the echo chambers in social media. So how do we start to move forward in a way that brings diversity and respect for diversity into those kinds of public conversations? Is it the mainstream media that we kind of hang our hopes on and try to reform that? Do we do the same in social media? And again, I think it's not an either or, but how do we start to build those diverse and respectful public discussions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's not an either or, is it? Because, of course, those different types of media are used by different demographics and audience. So I was just reflecting on, just as you were speaking, I was reflecting on mainstream media and growing up in Britain, you know, in the 70s, early 80s. And the mainstream media was exactly the same then as it is now. And I was just wondering, is it been able to, you know, across whatever sort of politics or perspectives, recognising the power of these different forms, regardless of, I mean, I would be, you know, horrified by particular aspects of mainstream media, but it has an incredible cut through. So if I can just tell a little story of when we were doing the work of the WHO's Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, and we were writing the report at the end, and it was, you know, this big thing of, you know, it was sort of 220 pages of middle class focused analysis. And the best advice I was ever given was to go and spend with the team, the writing team, to take the writing team and spend time at The Sun with some of the editors from The Sun. And we did that. And it was excellent for two reasons. One, it helped us cut it because they're just exquisite writers. I might not necessarily like what's in it, but they're exquisite writers. And two, it was just a beautiful mirror to say, who on earth do you think you are that you can come in and have this middle class imperialism? And, you know, of course, I thought that was just horrific at the time, but it was so true. So that was a bit of a ramble in that, yes, the mainstream media is completely captured by a neoliberal model, and it's completely controlled by a tiny number of very right-wing groups, and increasingly so. But it has such an audience. And I think some of the lessons, therefore, is how to frame, so Anna Greta, you know, the narrative, really understanding narrative, and how you can be you have to be happy with the fact that your story in some mainstream piece sits alongside another story that is just, you know, sort of diametrically opposed to what you're trying to say. But that's okay because it's out there. In terms of this social media, so one of the things that really worries me is we have no real regulatory framework. And I do think there are some regulatory levers that might help both control some of the terrible hate discussions that go on in there. I'm not entirely sure how it would help break those echo chambers, because you're, of course, dead right with that. But maybe there's a role for the bots in being able to jump across the boundaries that we, you know, that we create because of our sort of worldview at that personal level, but using bots. I know certainly colleagues within the European Commission used to do that way back in the early days of social media. They were using those types of techniques to jump across the political divide to get into the headspace or the ear of some others. So I think we need a conversation with colleagues within tech who really understand how you use those tools. But other than that, I'm rambling.
No, so it's narrative and utopia and how we communicate that. And I think that's part of there's some of the tools that we can use to make the process of change easier, because it's easier to find a new future when you can imagine what it might look like. And I think, you know, you can see that in the Royal Commission into Natural Disasters work that's been done on the effects of climate change in Australia. They're spending some time imagining what the future might look like and working some narratives around that will be really helpful in preparing us for what could be a difficult transition ahead. So fantastically interesting ideas here.
I think it's also really exciting to think about the way in which we can have that conversation with people who work in technology and the way we can use technology in those ways. And I'm thinking, as we're talking, of The Social Dilemma, you know, that Netflix special that got such attention, but where we heard about people who have expertise in social media talking about the ways in which it is often used in such negative ways, but the ways in which it could be used for such positive purposes to kind of foster these kinds of more constructive discussions. So I think there is actually real optimism there. It's just shifting the paradigm towards something that looks a little more like utopia than dystopia.
And I suppose maybe in this discussion of that sort of that future helping to get towards that, I do think, you know, we have to, whose future, you know, who decides what that is. You know, I've got a particular perspective, we've all got a particular perspective, but there is a diversity of views around, and it just reminds me of some of the discussions we were having. The Climate Change and Health Alliance in Australia did this lovely work of that sort of imagining the future, and somebody in those discussions says, but there, you know, there's lots of different futures for among different groups, and surely they're all equally valid, aren't they? For me, it comes back to, if it is doing harm to people and the planet, then no, it's not acceptable. And we can get there in different ways. You know, that's where I say I don't necessarily have an issue with profit. Some people, of course, would like us to not have a profit model. But we can get there in different ways. But I think it's the, how do we get agreement on that end? What's the end that we're working toward? Are they?
So a follow-on question for that, actually, just around health and economics. How much do you think it matters that we reframe the economic approach from a health perspective?
Oh, I think it matters a lot. So I'm certainly not naive to think that the dominance of mainstream economics is going to go away anytime soon. I just don't think it will. It's been around for a long, long time. It's going to continue.
But I suspect we underestimate the harm that our economic model might have on our health and well-being in a community.
Well, and there's so much evidence around the harm that it is doing. So it's not for lack of evidence around this economic model. Well, I'm going to just backtrack a little bit, because the economic model has worked in a sense of, you know, it's lifted lots of people out of financial poverty. But it's done that in a way that hasn't paid attention to these other more social or environmental and health matters. So if you're only concerned about financial poverty, and Sharon, I'm pointing to you because this is what your multidimensional poverty index is all about and has illustrated so beautifully, is if you only fixate on the financial aspect of the economic model, then it obscures and lets off the hook all of the sorts of harms I think that you're speaking about, Anna-Greta. So thinking about that economic model in a way of for what purpose, and it shapes the nature of our labour market, it shapes the nature of our housing market, it shapes the nature of our education, it shapes the nature of our healthcare system, all of which matter for health and well-being. And the fact that the economic model shapes each of these things, and it shapes it differentially or inequitably, so of course leads to the inequalities in health and social outcomes, as well as all of the environmental harms. So we cannot separate the economy from health, which goes back to, I think, our remarks at the start of the podcast of right now we have a moment because health is right up there in the public and political discourse with the economy in a way that we have never had. Well, certainly not in my lifetime. We've never had that before. And people are recognising that it's not an either or, that they're so completely interconnected. So let's not waste this moment.
Mm. So, Sharon, we could, I suspect, speak for many hours, but we will need to wrap this up shortly. I'm going to come back to a really interesting question. And I wonder if you could paint for us what you think utopia might look like.
Well, so welcome to 2050. We've all got really good health. We've all got access to really good quality and affordable healthcare. We all live in ways that respect and collaborate with our neighbours and our colleagues. We have a government system that sets in place policies based on an economic model that front and centre is concerned about the well-being of the citizens. We live in 2050. We have absolutely nailed the problems of climate change. We've had incredible climate adaptation and mitigation policies. And in getting to that place, what we've done is we've introduced a social vaccine. And our social vaccine is based on principles of fairness, of diversity, of inclusion, of health, of environment, environmental outcomes. And it's meant that we've set up working conditions that actually allowed people to lead a life with dignity and hope. It means that we've set up an educational system that doesn't create two tiers within society. It means that we've set up a labour market, going back to our working conditions, but a labour market that's based on green jobs. And we've actually, in Australia, we've become one of the leaders in terms of alternative energy sources and business practices. And we have a governance system that means sitting at the highest level of government are, by law, are voices from civil society. It's chaired not by the Prime Minister, but by one of our Indigenous elders. And it has to have every government department has to address its key performance indicators that are based on social, health, environmental and economic goals. That's how we got to 2050.
That is a beautiful vision of utopia, and it doesn't feel like it's that far out of reach. It's just a little bit of work for us to get there. So, Sharon Friel, thank you so much for joining us today on our exploration of wellbeing economics. Your ideas and vision, as always, are extraordinary food for thought. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Sharon.
Lovely. Thanks for talking with you. Let's hope we get to 2050.
So, Anna-Greta, what did you think about some of those key issues that Sharon talked about, and also that vision of utopia that she left us with?
I love speaking with Sharon Friel. I love listening to her speak. I love the Scottish accent, but I also really very much always find that I have new ways of thinking about health and well-being, and thinking about how we can see policy change in a really pragmatic way to make the world into a better place. I took away quite a lot of ideas. What were your take-home messages from today?
Well, like you, I always love listening to Sharon's beautiful, gentle Scottish accent. But in terms of the key messages, I guess from Sharon's comments, but also across this series, the things that keep reoccurring to me are the need for us to think very differently about the way we care for and include those people within society who don't contribute in what we may often think of as a productive way. So the elderly, the young, people with disabilities, you know, they're the people where we see the Royal Commissions happening, where we see profit driven services destroying people's lives. And so I think, you know, to get to that utopia in 2050 that Sharon talks about, how do we think really differently about what contribution to society is and how we care for people based on different definitions of contribution. And the other part of that is, how do we start to reframe our society and our economic system? Mm. So the people who are kind of in that, what is now classified as the productive age, are not so overburdened with the need to work incredibly long hours or to search for paid work, so that we can actually start to contribute and think differently about and live differently within a well-being and caring society. So, you know, from Sharon's conversation, I took lots of really important inspirational messages about how we just need to think differently and start to act differently.
But it's practically useful. So I felt like the ideas that she gives us, we could start tomorrow. So the transition to a regenerative capitalism, I think that, you know, that the idea that people can continue to generate wealth will make a lot of listeners comfortable and happy with that idea. But imagine if we reframed, and I think this is where our whole conversation started from, is imagine if we framed our government policy, our social policy, our raison d'etre behind our economic activity through the prism of four metrics, through our societal impact, through and caring for society, through health and well-being, through the environmental impacts and caring for the natural environment, and through the economics. And if you just simply adopt a model where all four of those metrics have a similar degree of weighting, it would be getting close to Sharon's idea of utopia.
So listeners, you've heard today a vision of utopia that sounds rather appealing, and we're hearing lots of ideas about how we get there. So please do reach out to us and give us your thoughts. Tell us what your thinking is on some of these issues. You can find us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, or you can reach us via email on podcast@policyforum.net. Probably the best way is to join our Facebook group. Just type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar and you'll find us there. And don't forget to leave a review. We love hearing all sorts of reviews. We love it when you reach for that fifth star. And you can subscribe and listen regularly to our podcasts through Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favourite pods. Anna Greta and I will be back next week with another episode in this Wellbeing Economy series and how we might reach that utopia that we've been talking about today. So come and join us again next week.
Absolutely, Sharon. I think we'll be exploring a little bit further how to make this happen in practice. I'm really looking forward to the next on this series. Thank you again for today.
I think it's time for those practical steps, and thank you. I'm loving these conversations. We will see you next week, but for now, it's bye-bye from me.
Goodbye from me too.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.